They wanted this. Gave them that. It was indeed like this, and like that, and like this. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this is a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Dmitri Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony. Ninth symphonies are peculiar things. It all started with Beethoven, so many things do, when he composed his Ninth Symphony in 1824, more than twice the length of his Eighth Symphony. It also contained parts for solo vocalists and chorus. The text was comprised of Friedrich Schiller's Ode to Joy, which described Beethoven's utopian view of the world. This monumental, and we're going to hear that word a lot in this podcast, this monumental work proved to be the composer's final symphony and his final epic public statement. He would die 3 years later. Next would be Schubert's Ninth Symphony. Once again, we have a monumental work of, as Robert Schumann described it, heavenly length. Truthfully, Schubert was too busy writing music and then dying at age 31 to pay attention to the numbering of his symphonies, but this work, Schubert's Great C Major, will forever be known as Schubert's Ninth. Then there was Bruckner's Ninth, once again a fabulous work of great length. Sadly, Bruckner died before it could be completed. Dvorak's Ninth Symphony, the spectacular and monumental From the New World, would also prove to be his last. Gustav Mahler was so suspicious that his Ninth Symphony would be his undoing that he called his actual Ninth Symphony Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth, to avoid tempting the gods. Mahler's actual Ninth Symphony, really his tenth, would sadly prove to be his last, as he died at the tender age of 50 in 1911. So what have we learned from this discussion, mes petits amis? Ninth symphonies are monumental, and you're probably not going to be alive to write your tenth. The Ninth Symphony conundrum was even more complex for Shostakovich. His Seventh and Eighth Symphonies were already monumental works. Each lasted over an hour and was for large orchestra. Both symphonies were war works inspired by the Great Patriotic War, what we here call World War II. The Seventh Symphony, the Leningrad, is all about the actual conflict and the incredible resilience of the Soviet people. Shostakovich knew about this firsthand, as he was present during the siege of Leningrad and served as a fire marshal. The Eighth Symphony was all about the enormous human cost and suffering that the war created. No country suffered as much as the Soviet Union, whose civilian and military casualties numbered over 20 million. In October of 1943, about 2 years before he would begin writing the actual Ninth Symphony, Shostakovich said that the Ninth Symphony would be a monumental choral symphony, that it would be about the greatness of the Soviet people, about our Red Army liberating our native land from the enemy. A year later, in October, while celebrating the 27th anniversary of the revolution, he said, "Undoubtedly, like every Soviet artist, I harbor the tremulous dream of a large-scale work in which the overpowering feelings ruling us today would find expression. I think the epigraph to all our work in the coming years will be the single word, victory." In January of 1945, Shostakovich told his composition students that he was hard at work on a new symphony, which would be for vocal soloists, chorus, and orchestra. Suddenly, this symphonic plan was abandoned. Shostakovich gave up the monumental path and resumed composition of a new Ninth Symphony on July 26, 1945, about 6 weeks after the Great Patriotic War was ended. The work was completed on August 30th and came complete with a warning from the composer. He said, In character, the Ninth Symphony differs sharply from my preceding symphonies, the Seventh and the Eighth. If the Seventh and the Eighth Symphonies bore a tragic, heroic character, then in the Ninth, a transparent, pellucid, and bright mood predominates. The symphony was premiered on November 3, 1945, by the Leningrad Philharmonic, conducted by Yevgeny Mravinsky. The work shared the stage with Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. Shostakovich premieres were always exciting and highly anticipated events, and the audience was surprised to find that the work was only 25 minutes long, used a relatively small-sized orchestra, and was the least monumental and majestic work ever written. To the music, mes petits amis. Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony is written in five movements, with the last three played without a pause between them. Like symphonies of the classical period by Mozart and Haydn, the opening movement is written in sonata form. This is an 18th century construct that on a macro level has an exposition where we meet our themes, a development where they are, indeed, developed, and a recapitulation where we meet the themes once again. In a well-behaved sonata form, the exposition will have two contrasting themes, and though this is a very raucous and Haydnesquely humorous movement, it is a very well-behaved sonata form. Let's call the themes A and B. Theme A is a sprightly ditty that opens the symphony. Theme B. It's a snarky little march for piccolo. Note that it's preceded by a two-note fanfare on the trombone that feels completely out of place. After introducing us to his two principal themes, Shostakovich does the, at least for him, unthinkable. He repeats the exposition. This was a standard practice during the 18th century in works by Haydn and Mozart, but completely passé by 1945. In fact, this is the only Shostakovich symphony where he asks us to repeat the exposition. Before we leave the exposition, here are themes 1 and 2 back-to-back with the fantastic trombone-interrupting fanfare for good measure. Now that we're done with the exposition, here's the opening of the development, which works on theme A, and you'll notice that we're driving through a neighborhood that's a little less stable and our themes to be more in motion than in the exposition. Speaking of which, listen to what happens to theme B. It has definitely moved to the dark side. The beginning of the recapitulation where we meet our themes again, and they are definitely more worldly and a bit rougher. Here's theme A. Now, remember our two-note trombone fanfare? Our trombonist seems to have received a substantial self-importance injection and can't resist trying to insert himself into the proceedings no less than 7 times before we finally hear theme B. Here's our trombonus interruptus. Then we hear theme B, but this time the piccolo is replaced by a cheeky violin. The 5-minute movement, which contains an enormous amount of moods and thematic information, ends rather abruptly with a tip of the hat to theme B. If our first movement was circus-like and almost burlesque, the second movement of the symphony plumbs the tragic depths and incredible loss which must have been felt by every citizen of the Soviet Union. We begin with a desperate solo clarinet, accompanied by the bleakest of low strings. Eventually, the other wind instruments join in the plaintive melody, which eventually dies away. The other thematic aspect of this movement is played by the strings, which seem to be lurching blindly about. Eventually, this music reaches an almost painful climax. The movement ends, as quietly as we began, with a flute rather than a clarinet playing the opening theme. The third movement is a jaunty scherzo, which takes us away from the bleak lunar landscape of the second movement. We should just be aware that, like all things Shostakovich, what starts out as pure fun sometimes goes awry. Here's the opening. Then, midway through, the trumpets get to show us just how manly they are, with a bit of almost Spanish bravado, complete with a fandango rhythm. As mentioned earlier, movements 3, 4, and 5 are played attacca or without a pause between them. Eventually, our scherzo runs out of gas. And the fourth movement begins with some very startling and frankly frightening low brass. Is this dreadful fanfare a representation of Stalinesque cruelty? The horrors of the Nazi invasion? The sufferings of the Russian people? Frankly, you can take your pick. Juxtaposed against this chorale of terror is a single bassoon. It's fascinating that Shostakovich takes an instrument often viewed as comic and portrays it as the most human of all humans, the individual against the machine. As mentioned earlier, Stalin, and indeed the Soviet regime, wanted Shostakovich to write a great celebratory Beethovenian Ninth Symphony. True to form, in his own way, Shostakovich actually manages to quote Beethoven's Ninth in the most subtle and ironic way possible. The bassoon solo actually begins with two notes quoted directly from Beethoven's Ninth. Let's hear the Beethoven. And here, in the beginning of the bassoon solo, Shostakovich uses the exact two notes with the exact rhythm in a completely different way. Was Shostakovich thumbing his nose at Stalin? You bet. Would he go to the gulag for this? Probably not. Would Stalin have even realized it? Thankfully, no. Meanwhile, back to our movement. The brass are not appeased by the solo bassoon or amused, and they respond again with stentorian harshness. The The bassoon is undaunted. It returns to end the movement and triumphantly begin the upbeat fifth movement. Take that, low brass. Once the final movement is established, the orchestra joins the party. Eventually, like so many Shostakovich things, it gets a bit out of control. Finally, while the ending of the symphony is not majestic, it sure is celebratory. So what indeed is great about Shostakovich's Ninth Symphony? 1. The composer has found a totally unique way to pay tribute to his countrymen and his country. I'm sure there are many contemporary Soviet composers who wrote monumental works to celebrate the end of the Great Patriotic War, and I'm sure those works are all forgotten. What this symphony lacks in monumentalism, it makes up for in humanity. 2. Fantastic use of relatively limited resources. Without using a huge orchestra, we plumb the depths of sound and emotion. 3. Sometimes laughter is the best medicine. In Solomon Volkov's memoir of Shostakovich entitled Testimony, a work which is still controversial today, the composer is said to have stated, "They wanted a fanfare from me, an ode. They wanted me to write a majestic Ninth Symphony. Everyone praised Stalin, and now I was supposed to join in this unholy affair. And they demanded that Shostakovich use quadruple winds, choir, and soloists to hail the leader. All the more because Stalin found the number auspicious, the ninth. He would be able to say, 'There it is, our national ninth.' I confess that I gave hope to the leader and teacher's dreams. I announced that I was writing an apotheosis. I was trying to get them off my back, but sadly it turned against me." If you'll be so kind as to allow me a couple of postscripts. Yevgeny Mravinsky, the conductor who premiered the work, said, "It scoffs at complacency, pompousness, the desire to rest on one's laurels and sing one's own praises. However, the symphony is not entirely ironical. It also has genuine lyricism and profound sorrow." Shostakovich's Ninth received initial positive reviews, but these soon gave way to official condemnation a year later. The piece was criticized for its ideological weakness and failure to represent the goals of Soviet society. The symphony was banned until Stalin's death in 1953 and would only receive its first recording in 1956. On a strictly personal note, I think Shostakovich's Ninth, though it bears a closer resemblance to Beethoven's Eighth Symphony than his Ninth Symphony in terms of length and mood, is a fitting addition to the Ninth Symphony Club. In his own way, this most Soviet/Russian composer has shown us his personal utopian vision for humanity. I'm WBJC's Jonathan Polevsky, and this has been a Baltimore Symphony Orchestra podcast for Dmitri Shostakovich's Symphony No. 9.